Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is James Curtis, who has a new book titled Spencer Tracy, A Biography. James Curtis has written three other biographies, one of James Whale, a director in Hollywood in the 30s, a biography of W.C. Fields, and a biography of another director titled Between Flops, A Biography of Preston Sturges. This book took 6 years to write. Why Spencer Tracy, and why now?
Because I've always been fascinated by him, and I've never done an actor, and I never thought that he had been done correctly in the past. The only really legitimate biography of him was published in 1969. It's a good effort, well written, but it was written too soon after his death. A lot of people were still alive. The archival resources weren't there at that time.
You also had access to a tremendous amount of material. You were able to talk to Susie Tracy, mm-hmm. his daughter, who's still alive.
Yes.
And that included an unpublished biography of Tracy's wife, Louise, is that correct?
A memoir, yes, about her rearing their son, who was born deaf in 1924. And it was never published. Louise Tracy was a very good writer, and I was delighted to have that material.
Why do you think it wasn't published?
There was a point at which she didn't feel like publishing it, I suspect. It was never fully finished. She was writing it at a time when she really didn't know what she was going to do with her life, and then came the possibility of founding the John Tracy Clinic, and so the book went on the back burner at that point.
Is it also possible that the complexity of her personal life became a little bit too much, because that would be around the time that Tracy and Hepburn got together?
Yeah, that's true also, and that may be part of it, although she was careful about what she would reveal about her personal life. One thing about Louise Tracy, she was incapable of lying. She would not speak of certain things. She would say, we're not going to talk about that. But she was incapable of telling a lie, from what I could tell, and her daughter is the same way, although she never ducked a question. But both of them are extremely truthful people.
You also had a chance to chat with Katherine Houghton, who was the niece of Kate Hepburn, plus, I guess, a diary of Spencer Tracy.
He kept a date book starting in the mid-1930s, and they documented the times that he had trouble with the bottle, when films were started, his thoughts about various films, and so those were quite valuable as well. His daughter had those.
Stephen Camphor recently wrote a biography of Humphrey Bogart, mm-hmm. trying to figure out what Bogart said to today. Mm-hmm. Do you feel Tracy, in some respects, speaks for today, or is he really a star of the past, like, say, Gable?
I think that he represents a period of time when somebody was exalted in that position in a way that's not possible anymore. At the same time, he was a very modern actor, and I think that's what we see in him today. Gable is very much a creature of the screen. Tracy is more like the guy next door. He had that way of putting across a role, a way of putting across dialogue that seemed entirely natural, and that was unusual at that time. He wasn't a theatrical actor at all.
What I recall from having seen some of his early films in the past, what struck me was that most actors of the pre-code and even the code period were very stilted, and he never was. I kind of felt like he walked in from a different world.
Yeah, that was the effect he achieved. There were a lot of things that contributed to that. One of those was that he never wore makeup. He always maintained a good tan. He could photograph without makeup. He never looked good in makeup.
James Curtis, when you decided to write this, you'd only written, those three biographies before. So
yeah.
did you have any idea what you were getting into?
I had a sense of it, sure, yeah. There was a lot of material that was out there that was inaccurate, deliberately so. I set out not to sensationalize his story in any way, and I set out to find out who he was beyond the legend, and that was what took so much time, developing the material.
Well, let's go a little through his career before we deal with some other issues. I usually kind of skim a little bit past mom and dad and grandpa and grandma. I don't really care to get into the meat of it. But there was an entire period, the early part of his career, before he actually came to Hollywood. And you focus several pages on that era, which was the era when he was in Broadway during the 1920s, an era that we know very little about. Where did you go for your info?
Certainly at that time, Louise was present. She remembered a great deal. There were also, from Louise Tracy, interviews that were conducted in 1972. also unpublished, for a possible autobiography about the founding of the John Tracy Clinic. Those never went anywhere, but she submitted to about 6 Q&A sessions, talked a great deal about their Broadway years, so a lot of that material is straight from Louise Tracy. There were a lot of archival things that were available from Chester Erskine, who directed The Last Mile, for instance. Some of the people he was on stage with, like, for instance, Selena Royal, she left an unpublished autobiography. She was present for some of the major incidents in his stage career, so it was great to have her memories. So over a period of time, a lot of things came into play, but at the same time, it was tough tracking them down. That was part of what I enjoyed the most about doing this book, was the detective work involved. To me, that's a lot of fun. Some writers hire that out, have other people do it. I don't do that. That's my fun.
Was there anything about his Broadway career that you had no idea about that struck you as new, that kind of changed your feeling?
Well, in terms of his Broadway career, remember also that he came from years in stock, dramatic stock, primarily in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and that was grueling training, but very good training for an actor. You did a different play every week. You were rehearsing next week's play while you were performing at night the current week's play, and you were forgetting last week's play. He excelled at that. He had almost a near photographic memory. That helped him a great deal. When he got to Broadway, he ended up doing a lot of shows that lasted very short periods of time. You know, he was on a show for about 3 weeks, and then it closed. It's amazing that he wasn't out of work any more than he was, because he tended to go from one show and step into another show. It was still quite precarious financially for them. He replaced Clark Gable in a show at one point, as a matter of fact. They met each other for the first time in 1927, I believe. When he got The Last Mile, he was sure it was going to be another flop. It was a grim thing. There were no women in it. None of them were going to wear makeup. All the effects in terms of the facial features alike were going to be achieved through lighting. He was sure it was another dog, but he had no choice but to take the part, and that was the part that made him.
That was the part that got him over to Hollywood,
yes.
Where he languished for several years. I didn't know this in the studios of Fox. I mean, I guess now we think of Fox as one of the big studios of the 30s, mm-hmm. but at that time it was halfway between MGM and Gower Gulch.
The problem with Fox was the management at that time, because Fox technical quality, the standards, production standards at that time, were as high as any in the industry. They had some wonderful cinematographers working for them, et cetera, behind the camera people. But in the case of story, a lot of times, the sense of story and structure at Fox was deranged, I guess is about the best word you could use for it. Oftentimes their films jump genre in the third act, and you feel like you've stepped into another film all of a sudden. Tracy was quite frustrated doing that. They were putting him in four or five films a year, usually in roughneck parts of one sort or another. His best films were done on loan away from Fox, with a couple of exceptions. And he was quite frustrated. He very quickly, because of the condition of his son, the need of relatives that he was supporting, he needed the money that Hollywood paid. But as an artist, he was extremely frustrated by the material he was being afforded, and it really did serious damage to him at that time. He was very unhappy. Occasionally, he got a very good one at Fox. The Power and the Glory, for instance, is a good example of that. It's a film that predates Citizen Kane, but in a lot of ways sets the same structural standards, written by Preston Sturges. And Tracy is wonderful in it. Quick Millions, his first film under contract, was quite good. Gangster Picture. So occasionally he got some good material there, but oft times he was just shoved in whatever was handy at the moment. And he was expected to do his job and be a good boy.
Well, one thing that's not in the book, and I noticed it as I was sliding past it, is Hollywood changed on July 1st, 1934, which was the institution of the code. Mm-hmm. But from reading Spencer Tracy, James Curtis, the code was affecting him before, and it didn't seem as if, at least for his career, that enforcement made much of a difference.
It did in the 40s, believe it or not. Later on, at the time that the code was enforced, it was a period of transition for him where he would very soon end up at MGM, which is where he flowered. In the 40s, there are a couple of major films of his that were, in effect, I think, ruined by the code. A Guy Named Joe and Keeper of the Flame, those are very good films, but because of the code, in both cases it had to do with suicide in the final reel, and that was not permitted under the code, and so they had these tortured endings on both of these films. Or, no, let me take that back. Suicide in the case of A Guy Named Joe, and murder in the case of Keeper of the Flame. In one case, you couldn't show a suicide. In another case, you couldn't show a murder that wasn't punished. And in both cases, that essentially spoiled the films, I think.
It seems that in the 30s, the studios themselves were self-censoring,
yeah.
Whereas by the 40s, it began to fall more, I guess, on the producers.
Well, some of the studios were willing to fight the Breen office more than others. MGM was not. MGM is a producer's studio. Paramount was willing to fight, and the evidence of that is The Miracle of Morgan's Creek by Preston Sturges during World War II, an unplanned pregnancy that ends up turning into a national news event. It's amazing that that got passed, but they were willing to fight for that, and MGM was not.
How did they get through a name like Cock and Locker?
I think it was James Agee that said, if I'm recalling correctly, watching the film was a little like taking a nun on a roller coaster, and either the Breen office had been lulled into a compatibility for which they must be congratulated or raped in its sleep, one of the two. And so it could be done, but MGM wasn't willing to go to the mat on these things, and both of those films were big commercial hits, so they could just shrug and walk away from it, but they were not artistically satisfying.
And then as time went on, his alcoholism began to get better of him.
Yes, well, especially in the early 30s, because in 1933 he had a very public affair with Loretta Young that almost could very well have ended a marriage. And when that blew apart, he, as far as we can tell, that's the first real bender that he went on, where he locked himself away and didn't come out for a couple of weeks. And when he did come out, he was taken to the hospital in an ambulance.
And this repeated on and on. Even, I mean, there was a period when he was dry from the mid-40s to mid-50s.
Mm-hmm, about 10 years.
But after that, when he went on these benders, I mean, yeah. It was kind of startling. I mean, you couldn't get information about what would happen during those two-week periods. He just vanished.
He just vanished. Well, he by that point was used to partitioning his life in such a way so that he knew if something like that was coming on, he would take himself out of the picture. I mean, there are people that knew him very well and never saw him with a drink in his hand. His daughter never saw him with a drink in his hand. We did, however, have access to his medical records, thanks to his daughter. And so we, for instance, I'm able to document one session where he dried out and the things he went through during that process. That's straight from the hospital records.
Well, the 30s and 40s at MGM, incredibly well documented.
Yeah.
How do you, as a biographer, try to, you know, kind of wrestle that material so that it doesn't take 10,000 pages?
No, well, you try to stick with what's germane to your character, your subject, in other words. So there's a lot of material that I left on the floor simply because there was no rational reason for including it all. Use an example, the film It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. There's lots of interesting things to write about the making of that one. But a lot of it doesn't pertain to Spencer Tracy, so I've got it in my files, but it's not in the book.
And in terms of sources, did you make sure that there were multiple sources? How much did you rely on single sources? Because that gets into your afterword,
yeah,
which we'll talk about in a bit.
Yeah. Multiple sources when at all possible. A lot of times that means going back to the archival record to see how it presses against what someone has said. In terms of being able to pick up the phone and have two different sources like they did in All the President's Men, well, those people are dead now. So you're faced with a situation of judging in every individual case what's credible, what seems to make sense, and what matches what we know archivally speaking. So you develop a comfort level with certain informants, such as Joe Mankiewicz, and perhaps you step a little bit away from some others.
Well, that becomes very, very problematic in many respects when Kate Hepburn and Spencer Tracy meet and have their relationship because there's nothing on the books to say they ever slept together, and yet they were together all the time.
And I don't say they slept together. I'm sure they did. But other than having been in the room with them, there's no way that you're going to know that. But I think that's very true. Katharine Hepburn gave a couple of unpublished interviews on the subject of Spencer Tracy. And I had access to both those transcripts, and those were conversations she had in the early 1990s, and she was very frank.
What did she say?
Most of it is in the book. She talked a lot about grappling with his drinking and how she would handle him during times when he was somewhat out of control. I think that she decided early on to insert herself into his life and, in effect, help him wrestle with those demons that afflicted him. And I think it's very true that she sustained him. We would not have some of his later performances today were it not for her.
In terms of trying to understand as a biographer, and this is where it gets a little bit dicey, I think, in terms of trying to understand motivation, we can never really understand it because we can't get into the head of someone else.
No.
And that becomes kind of difficult. It's easy obviously, when we're talking about career issues.
Yeah.
It becomes much harder when we're talking about personal issues. How do you try to play that? How did you play that with James Whale, W.C. Fields, and Sturgis, and how do you play it with Tracy?
You look at the patterns in their lives and their past behaviors. I think one of the things that takes so long about writing a biography of this sort is you have to come to the point, immersing yourself in the material, where you're able to regard your subject as a character, in the sense that you get to the point where you could put them in a situation such as you would a fictional character, and you would pretty much know how they would react to it. You've got that within you. What the biographer is doing is forming a bond of credibility with the reader, I think. And at some point, the reader decides whether you're trustworthy or not. I think that because I've gone through thousands of pages of transcripts and files and records, et cetera, so that the reader doesn't have to, the reader has to decide at some point that what I'm reporting as a result of that is reliable. And I think every individual author has to go through that transaction with each individual reader. Sometimes people are going to have a credibility problem with what you have to say. Others are going to decide that you've done your work well and that there's something to pay attention to here. Part of it also is having a body of work, having done other books in the past where people have a sense of how you look at a subject.
I'm thinking specifically of Joan Pizer, who's a biographer, mm-hmm. who, writing a biography of Gershwin, and in speaking to one of the few living people who knew him, a guy named English Strunsky, mm-hmm. he said that Pizer spent a lot of time trying to get information about whether George was gay, and finally Inge said something like, well, he was too busy screwing the chorus girls up and down Broadway to have had time for that. So what Pizer did is she took it around, and suddenly she was blaming him for not being able to settle down and taking a moral stand on him.
See, I don't agree with that at all. I don't think it's the biographer's job to render judgments or express disapproval. I think that's where authorial ego comes into play, and I dislike that very much. I think it's important when you approach a subject like this not to have an agenda. My agenda, if there is one, is I wanted to know what the truth was, and that's why Susie Tracy imposed no standards of editorial approval whatsoever on this project, and she signed whatever permission forms I needed to get the records I needed. She wanted to know as plainly as possible what happened. She wanted to know the truth about her father, and that's what I wanted to know also. And so I think if you impose a preconceived notion of what you're going to try to find, you rob yourself of the ability to actually discover a great deal about a particular subject you might not be expecting otherwise. That's the fun of it.
And in terms of the afterward, I had been waiting in the book to see if you were going to mention the gay rumors about both Tracy and Hepburn, and there was nothing in the body. There is an afterward. Mm-hmm. I notice even that the woman who was supposed to be with Hepburn, Laura Harding, is mentioned exactly once.
Yeah.
You had an open mind as to what you might find.
Oh, sure, sure. I told Susie Tracy if I found out at some point that he killed the Black Dahlia, I was going to print it. Whatever I came across. At the same time, you've got to have a skepticism toward things that are told you or that you've seen printed in the past. And if something doesn't sound right, then you look into it a little bit. I must clarify, though, Katharine Hepburn was not my subject, and so it was not my goal to see whether she was a lesbian or not or bisexual or whatever. That was not of interest to me. Tracy was my subject. If those allegations were raised, they needed to be looked into. I did look into them. The archival record didn't support the allegations as asserted in other books.
Given that he hung out toward the end of his life with people like Cukor and that whole crowd, he could have been flirting and people took it seriously. Who knows?
Well, you know, but from the evidence of Cukor's own correspondence at that time, which is at the Motion Picture Academy in Los Angeles, he rarely saw Tracy. Tracy, if you look at the property, which I've gone and looked at myself, Cukor's house was over on another street. I mean, Cukor owned the property, but it was as Tracy lived on the street behind Cukor's house and down a bit, and you could not see from Cukor's house to Tracy's house. They were entirely separate parcels from a practical standpoint. And Cukor would write letters to Hepburn, and he'd say, I haven't seen my tenant in months. And that's true. He didn't hang out with that group. He was a very private guy. So when the gossiping that came from that group took hold, it didn't ring true simply because they never had much to do with Tracy, and Cukor said as much.
Nobody would know what happened on his bender, so we can't even talk about
that. No, not really. All we know is what he would say himself, you know, and if there were any eyewitness accounts. But, of course, the few people who witnessed those things were dead. Katharine Hepburn said what she had to say about it. He could be violent on occasion. I think, as Katharine Houghton pointed out, her aunt could be quite intrusive in situations such as that. And they might have grappled physically. We don't know that for a fact, other than she said one time that that sort of thing happened. And she would know, and it's not beyond the boundaries of disbelief to think that that could have happened.
Well, certainly if he doesn't remember it in the next day.
No, or the next week if he were on one of those lengthy ones.
An area that you seem to glide past also was the period of HUAC. There is mention of Hepburn speaking at a Henry Wallace event and being declared kind of pink.
Yeah.
But unlike when you read Bogart biographies, Bogart and Bacall were more actively involved in that than Tracy was, there was a lot of fear. Is there nothing to indicate any fear on the part of Tracy in anything that you found? Because
no,
you glide right past it.
There was more material which we took out because it related to Hepburn and not to Tracy. Tracy disapproved of actors using their position with the public in order to put forth political ideas, either conservative or liberal. He never lent his name to movements of any sort. Hepburn would. The reason I brought up the Hepburn business and the Henry Wallace business was because there was a period of time in which Hepburn was not working because of that. And the only time she got films for a period of about 3 years is when Tracy made films in which she could appear. That particular incident comes up when she appeared at the last minute, practically, in a film called State of the Union with Frank Capra. It was because the leading lady, Claudette Colbert, dropped out of the film. Hepburn had lost some films at MGM at that point because of her political views.
Bogart, at that point, was far more involved. At the time we're talking, which is the late 40s, early 50s, were Tracy and Hepburn not that close to the Bogarts?
No, they weren't actually. They got close to the Bogarts after Hepburn made African Queen in 1951. Lauren Bacall told me that after that, because he and Bogart were on the New York stage at the same time, they never worked together, but they did make their first feature film together. That was Up the River in 1930. They reconnected in the early 50s after Hepburn and Lauren Bacall became such good friends, because Hepburn, of course, was there in Africa, as was Lauren Bacall. So they got Bogart and Tracy back together, and they were quite close for the last 6 years of Bogart's life.
James Curtis, Tracy, on the other hand, was a pretty solid Democrat. And if anybody said anything about Hepburn, he nailed him.
Yes, he did.
And the thing that surprised me most, Victor Fleming, the director of Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz, was pro-Nazi?
Oh, that's what Anne Revere said anyway, who was cast in the Yearling, the aborted version of the Yearling with Spencer Tracy. Yeah, she made that statement. Anne Revere was a noted lefty, of course. And I question whether I should use that or not. And I decided to use it because Victor Fleming was well known and as a right winger at that time. And she said that was the reason why they did not use Flora Robeson, who was much better suited for the part, is because he was anti-British at that time. Fleming swung a lot of weight at MGM at that particular period of time. And so what he wanted is what he got. And that was one of those things I debated whether to use it or not, but Anne Revere said that.
Well, we know that Gable tried to get Cukor fired because Cukor was gay. That was the story that I had heard, that Gable got Cukor fired.
That's one of them. That's one of the gossipy ones. The best I could determine, Gable wasn't happy with Cukor as a director because he was throwing the emphasis to the women.
Okay.
That's another gossipy version of things, but I think that's probably closer to the fact. Also, Selznick was unhappy with Cukor, and that's documented in the memos. So I buy that. It should say something, though, about Gable, because one of the legends that's grown up over the decades was that Tracy and Gable weren't that close, that they in fact disliked each other, actively disliked each other. That's not true. One of Tracy's date books shows that when Carol Lombard disappeared over the skies of Las Vegas in 1942, Tracy got in his car and drove 9 hours to Las Vegas to sit with Gable that weekend while they brought the bodies down. I went through the local Las Vegas papers to see if it was noted that he was present on the scene. Nobody knew that, but it's documented in his date book. The reason that they did not socialize, I should point out, is Gable was a heavy drinker. He did not have the physical intolerance toward alcohol that Tracy had, however. Good, enthusiastic scotch drinker, and you couldn't socialize with Gable or go to his house without having a glass of scotch put in your hand. And Tracy, as somebody once said who was close to both he and Louise, all he needed was a dessert with rum in it to set him off. And so he had to keep his distance from Gable because of the liquor.
Well, one thing I noticed, I began to feel by the time I got to the mid to late 1940s, mm-hmm. yeah. is that the life of the movie star, which is kind of supposed to be the perfect life, yet we know all of these movie stars had incredible amounts of problems, mm-hmm. was not a great life. They worked till they dropped. They spent a few weeks recuperating, maybe not long enough, worked till they dropped again, spent a couple more weeks off, worked till they dropped, and often didn't even work in what they wanted to do. And after a while, the only thing that they could do, because they're sitting in their room, they can't go anywhere, yeah. everybody mobs them, yeah. is take drugs or drink or do whatever.
That's true, you know, and that's one of the things I wanted to get across in the book was the price that someone like Tracy paid at that time to be the person that they were, the figure that they were in the culture of the time. Tracy couldn't go out by himself. He found that when he had somebody with him that people wouldn't bother him as much. It was a trap, and there were things about it that I think contributed the pressure on him, the emotional pressure on him, and that's why occasionally he had to blow off steam by disappearing for a little while and getting loaded, and that's what he did.
Do you think you now understand him?
I think I understand him as much as is possible for someone who has spent 6 years contemplating his life and the events of his life.
Did you like him?
Yes. In the final analysis, he was a moral man, an ethical man, a dedicated artist who did the best he possibly could, given the coping tools that he had at that time and the hand that he was dealt. These are imperfect people struggling with extraordinary events, and this is how someone produced a body of work that is inconceivable for an actor in this day and age. He was a man of standards. He never personally lived up to his own standards, I think, personally and professionally. And I think that's one of the things that ate away at him. He always – there was this solid black core of self-loathing that I think animated him. There are times when you can see the power of that in some of the things he does on screen.
There's as much as you can gather of his acting technique. You did find people to talk about his phrasing, that he was always prepared.
Yeah.
And the one that got me was that he read scripts and then almost deliberately forgot what the other people were saying in order that he would have to listen to them.
Yeah, and he pointed out, and I think this is a very good point to make, is that acting is reacting. Great actors are great listeners. And so he had a way of making sure the material was there and at the same time a little bit in the distance. And he was able to listen to and exchange a line of dialogue, a cue from another actor, and respond to it as if he was hearing it for the first time. That was one of the reasons why he was so good on an initial take. And he went a little on the stale side if they had to do it again and again because he knew it better at that point. But he was always striving to reach for it a little bit because it created part of what his wife referred to as that natural thing.
Well, Spencer Tracy was also very self-deprecating about his abilities more early than later.
Yeah.
Do you believe it?
I believe in the sense that he felt that was necessary. One of the fascinating things I found about his early life was as a child he had a magic act, and he would do magic tricks for the family and neighbors and the like. And I think that's an aspect of him that found its way into his adult life also. He liked to hide the work. You don't see the wheels turning, as Bogart said about him. And he would work half the night. He suffered from insomnia, so he would work on his character, on his lines in the middle of the night. Then he'd come in the next morning, and he'd pretend he hadn't done anything. What are we shooting today? He'd ask the script girl that. Of course, she'd have a heart attack, but he knew the stuff perfectly well. Also, another thing that kept him from taking it too seriously or appearing to take it too seriously was that his father never thought it was quite a proper way for a man to earn a living. And he used to say back in the 20s when all leading men were pretty boys, he wants to be an actor with a face like that. So I think that was part of it, is that he always deprecated the profession to some degree, or at least his part in it, because it was something his father didn't take terribly seriously, and he was devoted to his father. His father was probably the most important single figure in his life. But I think he did take the craft very seriously indeed, and when he got good material, he was delighted.
There seems to be this idea, I guess, that we want to psychoanalyze and try to figure out what tormented them. And I guess with someone like Tracy, certainly the people who said he was gay said, oh, he's a closet case. And there's a tendency to say, oh, he was guilty about the fact that he left his wife or screwed around, or that somehow his son was deaf because of him. But it seems to me that when you're dealing with alcoholism, you're dealing with a disease.
Yeah. Well, in his case, the alcoholism ran through his family. His grandmother was from County Cork, and I think that he had the physical intolerance. And then he developed over time the need, and that's the deadly combination, I think. It provided a release for him. At the same time, it was something he could not fully control. He was tormented by that. He disapproved violently of what happened as a result of his time under the influence. This was something he could never reconcile.
James Curtis, 6 years. What did you learn that most surprised you?
It's tough for me to center on one or two characteristics, perhaps, in him so much as the overall impression of a man who struggled at a time that is not like today to do the very best he could with an imperfect system, imperfect material, and standards that were far beyond anything a rational human being could aspire to, both personally and professionally. I think it was so difficult for him, and I think that because of the things written about him in the past, a lot of which were not true as it turned out, people had come to regard him as a bad guy, the black hat in the Katharine Hepburn story. And he ultimately, to me, does not come off that way. And I hope he doesn't come off that way to the reader either. It's a story that does not lend itself to easy answers. It's not a black and white tale. There are no villains in it, as far as I'm concerned. I think Tracy was a moral, ethical man and one of the screen's very best actors. He left a tremendous body of work.
Did you see all of his films?
Yes.
How many times?
Well, in the case of the ones I like Inherit the Wind, I've seen them multiple times. I can't tell you how many. Others I've seen just once, the early ones especially, which you have to go to, say, for instance, UCLA, and watch the archival prints on flatbed readers. But I've seen all of them at least once. The only one that doesn't exist, interestingly enough, is the very first one. It's a Vitaphone short subject. The first reel exists without sound. He is in the second reel, which does not exist. I was able to look at the first reel at the Library of Congress just to see how the film was shot, the technique under which it was made. But that's the only one that doesn't exist, to my knowledge. Everything else is there.
And in terms of your research, what's the most serendipitous moment, and what did you look for and never find?
What did I look for and never find? I looked for incidences of bad behavior under drink that I thought were going to be there, including acts of violence against his brother who took care of him, especially in the early days. I didn't find anything like that. I was looking for things that really underscored the alcoholism, especially in the early days. I did not find that. I did not find binges in the 20s, for instance. It appears that the first time was in 1934 after the Loretta Young thing came to it. In terms of serendipitous stuff, sometimes, and I'm sure other biographers will tell you the same thing, you'll sometimes do an interview with somebody that is almost obligatory. In other words, somebody that you feel you should talk to, but you're not expecting much from, and you get wonderful things from them. I can use an example, for instance. I spoke with John Erickson, who is in Bad Day at Black Rock, and I was expecting it to be a 10-15 minute call. He lives in New Mexico these days. And we had the most delightful discussion, and he talked quite a bit about some things that happened on that film that I thought were quite illuminating, and they're in the book. You get that occasionally, and you're not expecting it, but when you get it, you're just delighted.
a couple of things I didn't know. Louise was not a Catholic. The rumor, of course, is that she didn't divorce him because she was Catholic, but he was Catholic. She wasn't.
No, she was Episcopalian. That's right. That's one of the many things that people think they know that they don't know. No, that marriage stayed together for reasons that I think are more complicated than simply saying, well, somebody was a Catholic here. I think that was part of it, but I do think also there was a tremendous bond between the two of them that existed until the day he died. He would not, I think, have achieved what he achieved as an actor and as a personality in films had it not been for Louise Tracy.
World War II, he never volunteered, and he was the same age as Gable.
Well, yeah, but Gable had a particular reason for volunteering, which is that his wife had just gone down in a plane. Tracy was in the service during World War I. He was not draftable in World War II. He chose to stay in Hollywood, where during the war he was the number one male star in the country. Not in the world, but in the country. Tracy had a very nervous, high-strung nature to him, which I don't think would have suited him well for military service. His way of entertaining at the bases was that he would go into the hospitals in places like Hawaii, and he would shake hands and just talk individually with the soldiers and sign autographs and do things. And he did one of those tours and decided that was the way to go. He was really not up to standing up in front of an audience at the Hollywood canteen and singing or doing scenes, that sort of thing, telling jokes. He was better on a person-to-person basis.
I think one of the most striking elements of watching his films over the years is that around 1950, 52, suddenly, almost overnight, and it's sometime, I don't know, between Adam's Rib and, I guess, Pat and Mike, he went from being a middle-aged man to being an old man.
Yeah, yeah. You see pictures of his father who died in his 50s, and he's prematurely lined and gray in his 40s and 30s. Tracy, that just came to him. He had that natural lined look, and he would never have dyed his hair. So when he went white, he left it white. And so he looked older than actually he was. You know, when he did something like Inherit the Wind, he was still in his 50s, but he looks like he's 70.
There's a picture of him when he's about 60 with Louise, and I'm going, my God, they could have been 75.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Louise was 4 years older than he was.
Yeah. James Curtis, the definitive Spencer Tracy films, if someone was not really familiar with him and they're listening to this, these films have to be available. What films would they see? Give four or five.
Four or five. Well, number one would be Inherit the Wind, which I think is one of the greatest performances ever put on film. Judgment at Nuremberg is another one, just to see him deliver that summation at the end of the film, which he did in one take, amazingly enough. I think Adam's Rib is a wonderful film because you see the interaction between him and Hepburn, and there are hints to their own relationship, I think, in that film.
There's a hint in your biography that a lot of that film was ad-libbed.
No, I don't think so. The script was written by Garson Kane and Ruth Gordon, and it was so good, it came together so well and was so good that Larry Weingarten, the producer of that film, said it was the first script he had seen in 30 years in Hollywood where it was ready to go right from the outset.
But there were ad-libs in that
film. Oh, yeah, there were ad-libs. Katharine Hepburn talked about some of them. They would start on a scene, and he would throw things in to see if he could throw her off. And she said they had the policy of not stopping the camera. So if he threw in an ad-lib, then she came right back at him. And that's one of the wonderful qualities in their films together, is that they could do that with one another. There's their chemistry, the wonderful thing about the two of them that delights an audience.
I was just thinking while you were talking that not long ago, Buffy the Vampire Slayer had these two actors who had a play together, and what they would do is try to gross each other out by chewing on garlic before kissing. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to the 30s.
Yes, it does. Gable did that to Jeanette McDonald on San Francisco. That's an old thing. I mean, that dates back to stage days. You know, there's an old story about two actors on stage, and one tries to throw the other one off. They're in the middle of a scene, as I remember, and the phone rings. And it's not supposed to. It's not in the script or anything. And the actress picks up the phone, and she realizes that her co-star is playing a joke on her. So she answers the phone and says, "It's for you," and hands him the phone.
Adam's Rib, what else?
I think The Last Hurrah is awfully good because it gets down to the essential Irishness that is at the base of a lot of what Tracy does on screen. Captain's Courageous is good if you're able to look beyond the somewhat Chico Marx turn that he gives in it. I think the reason he puts it over and the reason why he was given the Academy Award for it is because beyond the accent and the curly hair and the darkened skin and all of that, that's one of the few instances where he did wear makeup. He gets at the essential humanity of the character, and that comes through. You forget about it. You forget about all the trappings of the performance, and you get right down to the heart of the matter. And I think that was one of Tracy's great gifts, was that if you talk to actors that work with Spencer Tracy, he wasn't playing a character. He was that person. He had that technique, that way of immersing himself in the material to the point where it was no longer an actor playing a role, but rather someone turning into a person who was somewhat like Spencer Tracy, but the character and all of its depth. And that was quite unusual at that time.
Why do you think we will never see any Tracy's or Gable's, or will we?
Well, Gable was certainly a creature of the screen. Nobody in real life looks like Clark Gable. You know, he was designed to be photographed, and he certainly was designed. Tracy was very modern because he did it all from within at a time when that was not common. The period of time in which he was on the stage, actors worked with nose putty and crepe hair and costuming, and that's where they got their characters from. Tracy discarded all of that, and he brought it out from within. Today, that's a lot more common. It wasn't back then, and he did it naturally. He did not study the method. Sense memory wasn't in his vocabulary, but I think that on a very visceral level, he learned early on as a child how to absorb these things and play them back. I like to say, or I'm fond of saying, that if I'm asked about his influences as an actor, I say Bronco Billy Anderson, because he spent hours watching these old split-reel westerns in little theaters in Milwaukee and absorbing the performances, absorbing the characters, absorbing the situations. And I think that's the start of his technique.
As you talk about his best films, they're mostly at the end. It's because the other people around him are more modern than they were back then.
That, and also he was getting the kind of material that was really appropriate to him, and a lot of that credit goes to Stanley Kramer. I think Stanley Kramer, after 1958-59, when Tracy was working almost exclusively with him, that Tracy had roles that were designed for him, and Kramer insisted upon Tracy at times when perhaps the studio would have preferred other people. And as a result of that, Tracy had a wonderful final act to his career.
And his final film, which was, I guess, was Coming to Dinner, now I guess it kind of looks dated. On the other hand, he's as natural as ever.
He is. He was very ill at the time. You know, I think with Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, it's easy to get wrapped up in the black versus white situation, which does tend to make it look dated. I mean, the word colored is completely antique these days, but it gets used back then. One thing to remember about the characters in that film, all the parents in that picture were born between the years 1900 and 1910. I mean, they grew up with lynchings in the South being a regular course of action. It's easy to forget that these days, but I think that Guess Who's Coming to Dinner on a more basic level is a generational divide, and I think that's why that film has lasted, and it has a tremendous audience, a remarkable audience. Forget the details of it. It's about one generation trying to connect with another generation and not always succeeding. I think that's what speaks to audiences. I mean, the film is over 40 years old now, and it's still run on television on a regular basis.
James Curtis, you've finished Spencer Tracy, a biography. What's next?
William Cameron Menzies, a great art director and production designer. I've felt for years that there should be a book about him, and this will be an illustration-driven book. We've got wonderful artwork dating back to the early 1920s. Menzies was the man who was the father of production design, and we have his early storyboards for films dating back to the 1920s. He's, of course, known for sketching Gone with the Wind shot by shot and directing, later on, very close to the end of his life, a seminal science fiction film called Invaders from Mars.
And finally, James Curtis, what turned you into a biographer?
I don't know. It's strange. I guess curiosity as much as anything. There are people that I wanted to know more about that information just wasn't there. That's specifically James Whale, Preston Sturges also. And so I kind of fell into my natural curiosity to the point where if I wanted to read the book I wanted to read about this particular person, I was going to have to write it myself. And that has prevailed ever since. This is a perfect example of that with Tracy. These are the books I would want to read as a reader.
You've been listening to an interview with James Curtis, whose latest book is titled Spencer Tracy, A Biography. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.